Because if we hadn't established our own state exchange, we would have had Obamacare in Idaho. What a lot of folks and what people maybe don't understand, and the reason they don't understand them is because folks like Fulcher has not been telling them that we didn't have a choice. We were going to have an exchange in Idaho. We were going to have the Obamacare exchange in Idaho, or we were going to have Idaho exchange in Idaho. And, you know, I would ask anybody listening to this program to tell me when we have ever invited any federal agency into Idaho to run anything in Idaho. And the times that we have said, you know, the feds put it in on us, let's just let them go ahead and run it. We tried that in 1995 with wolves. And if it hadn't been for Mike Simpson and his efforts on the continuing resolution in 2011, we would still have the federal management in Idaho instead of Idaho management. So I gladly accept the blame for putting Idaho ahead of Obamacare.
The new numbers show 76,000 people signed up. The federal goal was 40,000 people. So as someone who does not like Obamacare but who set up the state-run exchange, right, how do you interpret those numbers?
I interpret those numbers that they have faith in Idahoans because Idahoans are running it. I see these other states that chose not to have their own state exchange and to have the federal government do it. I see them having huge problems, and so I would say maybe not as many Idahoans would have signed up had it been the federal exchange instead of Idaho.
Senator Fulcher has said that he's certain that you will expand Medicaid if given a third term. You said in your State of the State in January that you're still studying other states, want to figure out what the best solution is for Idaho. If you're reelected, do you think you'll ultimately expand Medicaid here?
Well, that's not going to be up to me. The task force that we put together to take a look at it and study it, and that's the reason we delayed. We saw how the Medicaid expansion was having disastrous results in some of the other states. So that's why we decided to wait and see how, if any state successful, and how successful are they. And we've seen some pretty dynamic private sector ideas taking place in some other states, like Indiana, like Arkansas. So that task force will study those other states. We come back to the legislature. I'm not prepared to tell anybody or the legislature yet what I would recommend until I see the results of the task force. I would tell you that originally the task force said, go forward with Obama, or go forward with Medicaid expansion. And I didn't do it. And I didn't do it because we didn't know what the unintended consequences were going to be.
For those who haven't tuned in on this issue for some time, explain again what your reservations are with expanding Medicaid.
Well, number one, I don't know that it's sustainable. Number two, the old Medicaid system is broken. And so I'm not willing to add more and more people to a system that's already broken. And that's why we have asked HHS in Washington, D.C. At that time, it was Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, for waivers on a couple of areas. Number one, we want to pay for outcomes. We want to pay for success. I don't mind helping people if we are successfully helping them. But if the system isn't successfully helping them, I see it as a waste of money. And number two, I asked for and got a waiver that said that we could ask people to be a lot more responsible for their own health care. And if the doctor says to you, Scott, you know, you've got onset adult diabetes history in your family, you need to change the lifestyle. You need to make some changes. If you're overweight, you need to lose weight. If you smoke, you need to quit smoking. If you do these things, and if those people refuse to do that, I want to hold them accountable for it. And so copay is one of the ways to do that. And in the past, Medicaid has not allowed us to say to people, we will reward you if you help your doctor help your health. And this way we can say we will reward you or we will make you pay a bigger share unless you do what your doctor says.
The Department of Health and Welfare estimates there are more than 70,000 Idahoans who don't qualify for Medicaid right now, but they make too much money to qualify for subsidies to buy a health insurance plan through the exchange. If some of those people are listening right now to this conversation,
right,
what's your message for them?
Well, my message for them is that Obviously, that gap that was caused by the rules and regulations in Obamacare is one of the things that the Republicans have said, let's repeal most of this and repair it. Let's change course so that everybody, we have a responsibility in this nation to have equitable treatment under the law of everybody. Then we ought to be able to treat them all fairly. And in this case, the gap that they left in there was not fair.
Recent report shows the state of Idaho has cut spending for higher education by about 40%, just a hair under 40% since 2008. Now, a small portion of that will be restored when the new budget takes effect on July the 1st. But the cost of going to college in this state has gone up dramatically in recent years. That's at the same time that Idaho businesses seem to say more and more often that they're not finding the workforce that they need to hire these higher paying jobs in the state. What would you do in a third term to address the cost of higher education?
I think much of what we did when we created the College of Western Idaho, we reduced increased the opportunity for a lot of students to go to school $125, $130 a credit hour for their first 2 years. What we've added to the high school optimum is dual credit. So students that have some time when they're juniors and seniors in high school can start taking college credits online. So that maybe in some cases they'll have their first 2 years of college finished by the time they graduate. No question about it. We made some tough decisions during the recession, but it wasn't just higher education, Scott. We made some tough decisions. We cut some of the agencies, and very important agencies in Idaho. We co-located a lot of agencies in Idaho in order to cut costs, because the alternative was, in order to balance the budget, which we're required to do by the Constitution, Article 7, Section 11, says that we can't spend more money than we bring in. And so if we were going to balance the budget, we were either going to have to raise taxes, which would have hurt our ability to grow the economy, which would have hurt our ability to put people back to work, because at one time during the recession, we had almost 9% unemployment. And it worked for us, Scott, because now we have 5.2% unemployment. We're a whole point and a half ahead of the nation, and we're the fifth best financially managed state in the union. We're the fifth best place to do business in the union. And I think that's why we're coming out of this recession faster than anybody else. And that's why our economy actually grew $8.5 billion during the recession, when not only was the national economy in the tank, but so was many other states, and still is.
But I know there's going to be a lot of people who hear that, and they say a lot of the jobs we've created pay very low. Idaho's ranked 49th, 50th, depending on what rankings you look at, of state wages in terms of what workers here make. So we've been creating jobs, but they haven't been very well-paying jobs.
Well, a lot of them are brand-new jobs and brand-new industries that we are bringing into the state. And I don't know about you, but when I was first in the employment pool as a young man, in fact, as a teenager, I was paid according to how much I could improve the value of my employer's service or product. And I would tell you that I don't think I got more than one or two paychecks before my pay went up, because the more I learned the job, the better I could produce for that employer, and I was worth more value to them in delivering that service or building that product. Those people that keep saying, well, we ought to raise the minimum wage, we raise the minimum wage, you're going to see a corresponding raise in the unemployment rate in Idaho and a corresponding decline in the amount of young people in Idaho that get a chance to earn some understanding of a job, to earn some education of a job that they might not otherwise get.
We had a conversation, I think, late last year, early this year, with the new head of the State Labor Department, Ken Edmonds, and he talked about sort of the Band-Aid is not the right word. It's
That's
not the
right
word he used, but
yeah,
using some of these new jobs to get people off unemployment here as the economy has begun to recover.
Right.
But then now sort of signaling a need to shift gears a little bit, change focus on higher-paying jobs. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And I think those folks that went to work at lower-paying jobs at one time, in some of the industries, are now getting paid much higher wages because they've had a chance to do the job and improve that service or product for their employer. Ken Edmonds is doing a great job. We've got great expectations. Ken knows that job well, and he knows the value of education, having served and how it relates to workforce development, having served on the State Board of Education. He comes out of the private sector. He understands that when he was running his company, he wanted smart people making smart decisions, researching for his next generation of product within his own company or service within his own company. And that's the value that we get from education, is a well-educated workforce. There's a reason that we have a goal of 60% of the people between the ages of 25 and 34 that will have a post-high school degree or certification of skill of some kind in the very near future. As we work toward that, we're going to see the average wage and the average income of the family in Idaho go up.
Let's talk a little bit about gay marriage, Idaho's ban on gay marriage, mm-hmm. specifically in the Add the Words protest. Do you sense any sort of real changes coming up in the state of Idaho on those two issues in the next several years?
You know, it's not unusual for, whether it's the Chamber of Commerce or the Farm Bureau or the insurance industry or whoever it may be that has an interest in a particular bill or a particular issue, to get a venue and then ask the legislature to come to that venue, and ask the governor to come to that venue, and then they give their ideas, what they want to see, what kind of legislation that they want to see. But I would hope that those efforts next year, would call a meeting with the legislature in their own backyard, in their own venue, and say, okay, this is what we want and why.
Would you go?
Sure. I told them I'd go this year. I said, you need to call it when I'm available, and I'd be more than happy to tell you when I'm available.
How comfortable are you with the direction of the GOP in this state in the last several years?
Well, you know, the GOP, those that that wanted to close the primary, and I disagreed with that. I thought I'm kind of a Ronald Reagan fail bat kind of guy, that the bigger the tent, you know, those people that I agree with 80% of the – only 80% of the time are not my enemy. I think the bigger tent and the more diverse thought – that we have is good. I believe the Republican Party still stands for constitutional limited government, and I believe that's the direction I've taken the state. But there are areas where I've disagreed with the Republican Party. I was unfortunate that the Republican Party didn't see my advice on the chairman of the party back in 2008. And they took my chairman out of the position and established theirs. I think the Republican Party in Idaho for the future needs to focus on our problems instead of those things that we disagree on all the time. There's a lot of things that we agree on. They don't disagree with a balanced budget. They don't disagree with those folks that disagree with me on the general running of the party. They may disagree with me on that, but they don't disagree that we shouldn't be raising taxes every time we turn around.
Do you think that the direction that it's gone more to the right in the last several years has taken the party to a place that doesn't necessarily line up with the average thinking of the average Republican here in the
Well,
state?
I don't know. We'll figure that out May 20th.
Is this a litmus test?
Pardon me?
Is this a litmus test then?
I don't know. I think it's probably going to be a signal of where those people who vote in the Republican primary in May, where they want the party to go. Do they want the party to invite the feds into the state to run certain things in the state, like our health care program? And I think that's important. And that's why I think the election on May 20th is about the heart and soul of the Republican Party, as well as about what kind of a champion the Republican Party wants going into November.
How concerning is it that with that on the line that it will be a closed primary?
Well, this will be my first time that I'll have to face a candidate in the primary in a closed primary. And so, you know, it's who motivates their folks to get out and vote. The vote is going to be terribly important. I warned when they, as did Ben Usurcin, as did a lot of other folks on the, in the Republican Party, warned that if we closed the primary, that we would really subdue the vote. And the first closed primary that we had 2 years ago, we saw just that. Normally we get 28, 29, 30, maybe even a little over 30 percent of the voting registered voters out to vote. But and we got less than 23% that time. So I don't like that trend. I like to see the Republican Party allow everybody that believes in us to vote for us.
I'm curious, if you lose, do you think it's because of a closed primary?
Well, no. It'll, if I lose, it'll be Scott. It'll be because somebody else got more votes than I did.
But in part because it was a closed primary?
You know, there'll be a lot of different interpretation on it. I make no qualms about the fact that I'm working hard to get my voters turned out. Interestingly enough, those very people that you were just talking about on the division within the party, those were the people that wanted to close the primary. They were saying, no, we shouldn't have other parties selecting our champions in our party, our candidates to go into the November election. Then those were the very people that went out and invited the libertarians, invited Democrats, invited constitutionalists, invited all these other folks that they were so afraid of a few years back that we had to go to court. And the court ruled that the party has and the Central Committee makes those decisions. But they've got a right to have voting in their primary whom they want. So it's a little bit hypocritical, I would say, for those folks to still say how important a closed primary is when they were the very ones sending out invitations to anybody and everybody that they could possibly find.